Good morning and welcome everybody to... Hello, can you hear me now? Hello, can you hear me now? I don't think we need the mic. Hello, hello, hello. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this morning's session on regulating social mores, halacha, minhag, and the forging of public policy. Past and present attempts at limiting extravagance in celebrations such as weddings, brisim, bar mitzvahs, etc. I'd like to thank Rabbi Berman for convening this conference and convention, and I'd like to thank his entire staff for organizing this convention in such a wonderful fashion. And thank you all for coming and showing an interest in this subject. There's a correction outside on the name tags. It says Rabbi Dr. J. Berkowitz. The doctor is correct. The J is correct. The Berkowitz is correct. But the rabbi isn't, except if they wish to convey the rabbonis to Dr. Berkowitz this morning. The rabbi really should have moved down one line to my name, where the Reuben is correct, the PhD is correct, but the last name is wrong. The last name should be Gross, G-R-O-S-S. This morning's presentation will be broken into three parts. I will spend the first few minutes talking to you, introducing the problem of lavishness in wedding celebrations, discussing also the halachic aspects, the mitzvah indeed, and then Dr. Berkowitz will discuss leadership roles in forging policy among Jews, and he will discuss historical perspective of the 17th and 18th century. And following that, I will spend a few moments talking about the contemporary scene, what can be done about this specific problem. It is very fortunate that Jews today in America are free to celebrate weddings and bar bat mitzvahs without having to hide their simchas from a hostile external environment. And how wonderfully joyous indeed are these simchas. It is sad, however, that these simchas are becoming increasingly lavish and expensive, often going considerably beyond the point of reasonable expenditure for many parents, especially for those who have to marry off 3, 4, and 5 children, and beyond tolerable limits as a reflection of community values. My own interest in this subject began some 9 or 10 years ago, at a time when there were 15,000 Ethiopian Jews holed up in the city of Addis Ababa, waiting to be airlifted to Israel. This was called Operation Solomon at the time. Some of you may remember it. I remember reading in the Jewish newspapers that it was costing the worldwide Jewish community 50 cents a day to keep these 15,000 Jews alive. And the menu that they were being fed consisted of bread, potatoes, and beans. It so happened that on that weekend, my wife and I were at a wedding, and I juxtaposed the expense of the wedding with the expense of keeping those Jews alive. And I calculated that for what was spent during those 6 hours of a wedding, which was a typical Orthodox Jewish wedding, those 15,000 Jews could have been kept alive for approximately 5 to 7 days. 15,000 Jews for close to a week for what we spent on 6 hours. May I also mention the bar mitzvah syndrome? Many years ago, probably a little bit before the time of most of us, a bar mitzvah was a very simple affair. It took place on a Monday or a Thursday, if the boy's birthday happened during the week. He went to shul with his father, and he got an aliyah, and everyone said mazel tov. And after davening, his father yanked a bottle of schnapps from his pocket, put it on the table, brought a big cake, a sponge cake, homemade by his wife, cut it up, and the men had made a Borimane Mazonis, made a shakal, and they said Mazel Tov, and the boy went off to school. Mother, sisters were either at school or at home, older brother came, maybe an uncle or two. And when he came home from school, he told his mother what happened, and that was the end of the bar mitzvah, and he continued with his life. Today, bar mitzvahs, as you know, are lavish affairs. They can involve 200 to 300 people. Sometimes they involve 30 to 40 to 50 house guests on a Shabbos, in addition to the Shul Kiddush. Very often there is a Saturday night or Sunday affair. We're talking about anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 to $25,000. Same thing with a bris. There was a time when a bris was a simple affair. It took place in a home. Maybe there were 15, 20, 25 people at the most. Today, a bris is a big affair. It's a catered affair, catered breakfast, and again, you could have anywhere from 150 to 200 to 250 at a bris. These are beautiful affairs and lovely affairs and joyous occasions, but they are very expensive, and unfortunately, these are the standards that are being set by the community. The wedding used to be a simple wedding. Today, when the couple gets engaged, there's a vort. How many people here know what a vort is? Could you raise your hands? Okay, it's becoming popular. It's a spontaneous party that takes place within a few days. You could have anywhere from 30 to 40 to 50 people at a vort. Then you have an engagement party, which could involve a few hundred people and music. Then there is the families getting together, of course. Then there's an ofruf and shul, which could be a big kiddush. An expensive affair. There is the wedding itself, which today runs anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 to $60,000. Typical wedding among Orthodox Jews. And then there are the sheva brachos. In the old days, maybe one or two sheva brachos. Today, the young couples are getting four and five, maybe six and even seven sheva brachos. Many of them are catered affairs and also quite expensive. Now, you may have heard the expression shveretz zayin hayid. Well, there's another expression. Can't say Yiddish, but it's expensive to be a Yid, especially if you're an OJ, an Orthodox Jew. Let's start with kashrus. You begin with four sets of pots and pans. Now, what guy who would walk into your house would even imagine that you have four sets of pots and pans? He would mumble to himself, Medaf Zayin Meshikah. And then there's the dishes. Who has less than four or five or six sets of dishes, including Pesach? Kosher food is more expensive than a tray for food. And then we talk about yeshivas and chinuch. We're not only talking about 8 years of elementary school, we're talking about pre-K, nursery, kindergarten. We're talking about another 4 years of high school. If you want to go to a secular college like Brooklyn College or City College in New York City, fine. But if you want to go to a Jewish college, yeshiva college or Stern College for women, it's going to cost you more money. We're talking about $100,000 or more for the education alone. And as they say, you have a few children, 100,000 here and 100,000 there. Eventually it adds up. Now, in addition to chinuch, we're talking about tzedakah. Jews are rachmanim b'nei rachmanim. We follow the pasuk, pasach, tiftach, es yadcha, l'chicha havyon. Open your hand, give to your poor. We give to our own shul. We give to other shuls. We give to yeshivas, where our children go. We give to other yeshivas. We go to hospitals. We give to orphan asylums. We give money to Israel. We have money for Syrian Jewry, for Russian Jewry, for Ethiopian Jewry. We give to Israel Bonds. We give to UJA. We support the political organizations such as APAC and NORPAC and NATPAC and ADL. We are constantly being asked to give money, and we are, and we're very liberal with it. But there has to be a limit somewhere. And who has Rachmanis on us? Now, let's get back to the weddings. The $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000 that is spent on a wedding, and it is a joyous and lovely affair, but perhaps that money could best be used as a gift to the young couple, or a good part of it. In fact, what right to the original article, and there are copies, each of one should have one, and this is just a toned-down version of my article, was that after this particular wedding that I mentioned earlier, the couple called us up and thanked us profusely because of the gift that we had given them. We had given them a microwave. And I said to my wife, you know, they gave us such a profuse thanks, but for what that wedding cost, they could have a microwave in every room of the house, a TV in every room in the house, and a computer in every room of the house. Their rent could have been paid for a year, and all the furniture could have been bought, and they would still have money left over. So perhaps a gift to the young. Or maybe the parents could save this money, spend it on themselves for leisurely vacations. Or maybe to stop skimping. Or maybe security in their old age, or even for extra stock-up. Now, there are many people who could afford these luxurious affairs, but unfortunately, it sets a standard for many who cannot afford them. I interviewed a number of people on this. One man said, after the first bar mitzvah, I said, never again. But when it came to the second one, I was caught in a trap. His predicament was social pressure and the problem of sibling rivalry. He had to provide for his second son what he did for his first. One mother, a married orphan daughter, said, we took out a second mortgage loan on our home, and we asked for $25,000, but it wasn't enough. It came out to $40,000. What could we do? She looked at me. A father who had married off four daughters looked at me with chagrin and said, the weddings wiped me out. Now, originally it was the groom who paid the money. If you go back to Eliezer, after the father said, Hine Rivka lefanecha, kach volech, Rivka is yours, take her. Vayotzehu eved klei chesef klei zahav. Eliezer, who was representing Avraham for his son Yitzchak, took out valuable vessels of silver and gold and gave them as a gift. Later, when we have the unfortunate incident with Dina, Shechem ben Hamor wants to marry the girl, the adolescent, Hanara, and he said, Harbu olai mohar umatan. Just ask me for any dowry you want. Later, the Chumash talks about a man wanting to marry a woman. It said, Mohoryim Hareno Lola Isha, he has to give a dowry. So it was the response of the groom, or the groom's father, to pay for it. Later, it became an obligation on the bride, and today it is the bride's father who carries the burden of the wedding, although the grooms participate too. The Gemara cites the law concerning a dying father who designates certain jewelry and clothing for his daughter's nedunya. This was in Ksuvos 54b. Apparently, the nedunya was so important that it preoccupied the father even as he lay as a shchiv mara on his deathbed. He was so worried. Now, far be it from us to denigrate the importance of the wedding as a religious a bracha of Shavah Shalom, thank you God for giving us Thank you. Furthermore, it was ordained that fur-lined jackets were permitted, but provided that the sleeves and garments were not fringed in silk. And there were later sumptuary laws in Salonika, Italy, and Mantua, and Rome, periodic anti-luxury regulations. And this comes into where Rabbi Berkowitz is going to present many of these sumptuary laws of these centuries and how the rabbinic authorities formulated plans and organized ways of regulating social mores and halacha.
Thank you very much. Once again, I'll correct for the record that I'm not a rabbi. The focus of my presentation is the desirability and the legitimacy of social regimentation, and I'll be looking at this question from a historical perspective. The main issue with which I'll deal with this morning, not quite this afternoon, what determines, what defines public policy needs? What role does halakha play in shaping social mores? Who is authorized to decide what these public policy considerations are? Let me just read to you now a source by Rav Hai Gaon, who says the following. V'yoter mikol ra'aya mizeh, puk chazi ma'ama davar. More than any other proof with regard to what we ought to do, go out, see what the people are doing. This is the main thing. This is the basis upon which all is to be founded. And then, that is, after we go out to see what people are doing, how they behave, only then do we go to the textual material, the Mishnah, the Gemara, and we see what the text says. And then we interpret the text material in accordance with how we understand the social reality. It's in direct opposition to what we might ordinarily think. We might think that we go to the text material, and then and only then do we judge society. What's being suggested here by Rabbi Gaon 1,000 years ago is to go out first, see what people do, and then read the Talmudic or Mishnaic material accordingly. And that's a rather radical view, and I want to elaborate a little bit more by showing some historical examples. What about those areas that are not governed explicitly by halakha? What about those areas where the halakha is unclear? One area that could be considered, indeed has by Gerald Blitzstein in his book on Kibud Av V'Em, called Honor, Father and Thy Mother, an area that he has dealt with is the choice of a marriage partner. Is parental consent necessary? Interestingly, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, indicates that in his day, in much of Spain, the assent of a parent was required. Communities in Salonika, the Council of Lithuania, Vad Arba Aratzot, the Council of the Four Lands, all enacted takanot, that is, communal ordinances in the first half of the 16th century, warning against any young person entering into an agreement to marry without first receiving parental consent. This legislative flurry was generally intended to protect young women from scoundrels who might manipulate the situation. The halacha question, however, is could a child at whatever age violate the wishes of parents and marry the person of his or her choice? The Rashba, again, upheld the freedom of the individual to choose for himself insofar as marriage is a divine command which he, the person, should be best able to fulfill. The Maharik, Rabbi Joseph Kolin of Italy in the 16th century, rejects the idea of compulsion entirely, claiming that parental interference would get in the way of the goal of making the partners in marriage beloved to each other. The obligations of Kibud Av V'Em apply, he said, only in those areas in which the welfare of parents is directly involved, that is, their well-being. Parental interference in the area of decision-making about marriage is outside the purview, he said, of Kibud Av V'Em. Now, the Rama, Moshe Isserles, in the 16th century, in his glosses to the Shulchan Aruch, codified the ruling of the Maharig, that is, guaranteeing the freedom of the individual to decide on his choice of marriage partner, and said that a son must not or need not listen to a father's objection concerning marriage, and that indeed this objection, excuse me, this ruling of the Rama became normative. Interesting offshoot of this, would this extend to women as well? Would they also have the right to choose and to defy parental consent? Interestingly, most poskim, most authorities extended equal rights to men and women as far as that freedom went. And this is endorsed by a whole host of authorities in the 18th and 19th centuries, including the Noda Yehuda, Yecheskel Landau, and others. There are, of course, authorities who object to this, but generally speaking, the view of the Rama codifying the Maharik stands in halakha as the authentic and authoritative view regarding the freedom of individuals. Now, what's, I think, most interesting about this is that these views of the poskim, which became codified in halakha against what the communities were doing, that is, by restricting the freedom of choice of individuals. So here we have a case, really, where the communities were more machmir, more stringent, than were the halakhic authorities. Now, let me get to questions of legislation and restriction on social mores themselves, that is, on some shari legislation. I'm going to skip over some of the material I have to give us more time for discussion. But let me just make reference to a few things. First, that there are virtually no Talmudic norms with regard to the restriction or limitation on worldly pleasures. There are, as we've heard already, and I'm sure that some people may be familiar, there are occasionally references made to overindulgence having to do with modesty. But for the most part, as we know, the prevailing view within halakha is that we as individuals, as human beings, are permitted indeed to benefit and take pleasure in this world. The Ramban, as is well known in his Parish on the Torah and Parshas Kedoshim, says that one should not, of course, overdo it. One should not go beyond the line, so to speak, and become a naval bereshut Torah, a scoundrel with Torah license. But generally speaking, as the Gemara itself says, that a person who refrains unnecessarily from that which is permitted will have to give a din v'cheshbon at one point about that which he could have had and could have taken benefit from and did not. Nevertheless, in early modern Europe, in the 16th and 17th centuries, we find extensive regulation of consumption in dress, gifts between bride and grooms, the size of weddings and britot expenditures. And these takanot, interestingly, were enacted not by the rabbis, but by the kihilot, by the communities, and specifically by the lay leadership. Why did these, or how did these come about? Why was it that there were such detailed limitations placed on lavishness in dress, on ornamentation, on jewelry, on the size of smachot, etc.? So we can, I think, classify the motivations into several categories, depending on where and when these took place. For example, in the 17th century, in response to the Chmelnytsky massacres in Poland, 1648-1649, the Council of Lithuania, the Vad Medinat Lita, enacted takanot forbidding Jews from listening to music for a year, an entire year after those massacres had taken place, except on the night of a wedding, and second, from wearing lavish clothing for 3 years. The formulation of the communal register in this regard is actually quite revealing. It says the following: Umei Haraui, L'chol asher yirat Elokim naga b'libo l'tet lev l'hitbonen u'l'hitabel al kol tzarot tzurot ha'avirot. That it is proper for any person in whom yirat Hashem, the fear of God, is found in his heart, to contemplate, that is, to consider very carefully all that has taken place, u'l'hitabel, that is, to mourn. Evidently, the motivation here in the 1650s, after Khmelnytsky, was not so much a question of morality as it was one of mourning for that which had taken place, and to see, Rav Soloveitchik, of course, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, has written on this, that there's a direct connection between avelut and teshuvah, that is, engaging in mourning and introspection, leading ultimately to improvement of one's own characteristics, is understood by curbing its excesses in those areas. What were the motivations, if we could group them together? One, we said, was avelut, leading to teshuvah, mourning leading to repentance. Another motivation was economic, that there was concern about wasting of money, that communities that were so precarious in terms of their own financial existence, about their own viability, needed to make sure that individuals did not become impoverished, did not waste money. In 17th century Poland, for example, at the time when these various sumptuary laws were being promulgated, we know that there were a considerable number of bankruptcies, and there were failures to pay debts. Consequently, the community leadership took the step of ensuring that people who were not making good on their responsibilities, their financial obligations, would not at the same time be ostentatious in the way that they carry themselves, that there had to be a kind of correspondence between their sense of responsibility to others and the way that they carried on in their own lives. In Metz, which is the area that I'm most familiar with myself from my own research, in the 1690s we have a whole series of sumptuary laws where there is a growing emphasis on the public sphere as distinguished from the private domain. There's a particular concern about public ostentatiousness, lavish clothing once again, the wearing of jewelry, but I think this time what's particularly interesting is that there is absent entirely from this legislation any suggestion, any recourse whatsoever to religious or moral literature of Judaism. There's no argument that this is what ought to be done properly because of the Musar literature, or that this is the way that a Jew ought to conduct himself or herself, but rather there seem to be other motivations at work. They're not economic, by the way, because we have fairly good evidence that the Jewish community of Metz, that is in northeastern France, was quite economically successful in those years. But rather, since France itself was experiencing wartime travails, this was the time of the War of the Grand Alliance, it may have been indeed that the Jewish community, though somewhat immune from the larger economic problems of the day, could not appear to behave somehow independently of the plight of the French nation. And consequently, what we have in these laws is, I think, an effort to construct an image or to promote or project a kind of profile of public sympathy with their Gentile neighbors. Certainly not to arouse any resentment or jealousy on their part, and I think more directly to act in accordance with the difficulties and response to the difficulties that affected the nation, the French nation as a whole. The Jewish community does not seem to have been affected directly by the economic problems, but they expressed sympathy in the way that they restricted their legislation. Finally, the question that I began with, who is authorized to engage in the process of social regimentation? Indeed, it seems that lay regulation, that is the regulation by lay leadership of dress, consumption, even in areas of public morality, seems to have posed a direct challenge to the rabbinate and to the authority of halakha. A new overarching concern about the ordering of society emerged at this time in the 17th century as a central value for communal leaders, even when appearing to be occasionally contrary to the principles of Jewish law. We know, for example, that in the 17th century, in response to efforts by the Vaad Arba Arotzot to introduce legislation in these areas and just generally to regiment social behavior, the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkus, Maharal de Prague, that they had overstepped their bounds, that they should not have engaged. Reflected the will of the majority of the community or its representatives. According to Bachrach, sumptuary laws were under the legitimate jurisdiction of the lay leadership because the ethically neutral sphere. His language is delo shayacha bedin vedat shel Torah klal, that they do not concern directly matters of halacha, that religion of the Torah at all, or because they functioned as a barrier to immorality, siag Begeder l'Torah u'mitzvah. That is, either one of these reasons, because they are not directly halachic, or because they concern the public morality, which is apparently an area which is independent of, strictly speaking, halacha, justify, ultimately, their provisions. Justification, he asserted, lay the fact that they, these laws, were intended to sustain the collective body, in his language, shehatakanot heim letachlit kiyum hakibbutz, not the kibbutz of 20th century Israel, but the collective body of Israel, the collective body, the public interest of the Jewish community, is ultimately to be sustained through such legislation, even though, indeed, it's being enacted by lay leadership and not by rabbinic authorities. In Metz and in other places as well, the public interest emerged as a value which was free of absolute halachic constraints.
In view of the passage of time, I'll bypass 90% of the rest of my talk, merely allude to some of the work that I personally have done to try to bring this problem to the attention of the local community. I've been in touch with the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the Orthodox group of rabbis, the Orthodox Union, the OU. I've been in touch with a mid-organization. I wrote letters to commentator undergraduate newspaper of Yeshiva College. I wrote to undergraduate of Stern College for Women. I wrote to the Jewish Observer of Gilead Yisrael, Klal, and to a number of other organizations and newspapers, including the Jewish Press. I also interviewed members of communities of the Satmar Hasidim, of the Bava Hasidim, of the Lubavitch, and Gera Square. And I have some information on that, but again, because of limitation of time, I'll merely say that attempts have been made in many of these Hasidic communities, and some of them have actually published guidelines on weddings, bar mitzvahs, on limitations. In general, I might say that they all agree, though, that it's hard to control, and that many of them said to me, we live in the United States of America, and people can do pretty much what they want. However, certain standards are taking place, for example, among the Bava, for example, instead of a band of four, six, or eight people, they have one person as band. Some of these restrictions are holding. Among the modern OJ community, the Orthodox Jewish community, there are no restrictions. No one even attempts to make restrictions. And unfortunately, I think it's like a runaway horse. Something has to be done. No one person can do it. No 10 people can do it. It'll take an entire community to do it. There are many problems involved. It's a complex situation, psychological, sociological, and perhaps some ideas will emerge from today's discussion. So let's, first in terms of how many people here have actually organized a wedding and married off a child? All right, well, and perhaps we'll get some input from those people who have had personal experience. Let's open the floor for discussion if you want to ask a question to myself or to Dr. Berkowitz. Yes. The question is, what can you actually do within what is already accepted? Actually, the question has a hidden premise that certain standards are accepted, and maybe those accepted standards could be challenged. But from what I've learned from various other communities, a lot of things can be done and is being done. Limitations, for example, if we're talking about a wedding on how many musicians. So they limit it to, as I said, among one of these groups, I'm not sure which one, they said just one musician. Limitation of flowers. One of the groups says no flowers. Another.